Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Listen, Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd Alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 23 of Nerd Pride Radio. 23 is my favorite number. 23 is a prime number. That's a fact, an elegant prime number. That's my opinion. 23 marks my birth date, and it's also the second half of my bike lock combination in second grade. How cool is that? So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I'm awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's about seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. This week, we're proud to welcome a new sponsor. Nerd Pride Radio is now the official podcast of the Ministry of Silly Walks. Yay, us. Straight into it. First off, updates. All right. I told you last week I was reading The Hunger Games. Guess what? I finally finished. Oh, I could not put the thing down. Every night we had something going on, homework to take care of, you know, things to do. And so I didn't get to start reading until 9 or 10 every night, which meant I was up until a million hours in the morning. And so for about the last week, I haven't slept more than about 4 or 5 hours a week because of this book, which also means I've done absolutely zero show preparation. I have done nothing to get ready for this show today. You know what that means? Best show ever. So let's get right into it with more updates. The other thing, I also was going on last time about crack.com and how I'm, you know, talking about them stealing from me and their attitude. And so here I do this whole long rant about crack.com and their snarky meta sort of attitude. So I am not kidding. Not 3-4 days after I release my podcast episode, what does Cracked come out with? They come out with the 7 stupidest things that make people proud. Okay? And listed among those 7 stupidest things that people are so proud of, and they're mocking these things, that you shouldn't be proud of this sort of stuff. You're not even clever. You're not funny. All right? Among them, not liking anything popular, being cynical, not believing in things that no one actually believes in anyway. What did I say in my last podcast? It's the exact same points I was making, except they give crack.com writers an exception because all of these things are okay if you're really, really funny when you say it. I can't believe, and there it is sitting right next to the 7 least anticipated albums of 2012. You know, talk about being proud of not liking popular things. And right in there, they go ahead and make fun of Adam Lambert. They make fun of some, it's just, I couldn't even believe that, okay, they have 6 myths that everybody believes about space, thanks to movies. The cynical, feeding exactly into the stuff I was already saying. I mean, here they are pointing out the exact stuff that 40% of their articles actually are, and they're deriding that. They've out-meted me. That's the part that really hurts. Oh, they took my great idea, they made it their own, and they one-upped me. I can't fight against this. I can't win. They've out-meted me. They've won. I don't know how to fight this war. I think I'm just going to have to give up. It's so sad. And on that happy note, we go right into the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. Now is the time for me, where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my week, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. The first thing on my master list?
I thought this was
cheese
for weirdos.
That's right. It's the Cheese Culture Report. All right. I have tried a bunch of new cheeses. I've done Iberico, a Spanish cheese, Havarti, which I think is Danish. And the cheeses are just sort of becoming a blur now. I'm getting to the point where I think I've gone into cheese overload. And so I decided to scale it back just a little bit. I said, all right, let's not go wild this time. I was at my local store, and there, straight from Wisconsin, is a multi-pack of party cheeses. There was a salami cheese in there, which is really nothing but Velveeta with salami in it. So that part wasn't impressive. But then the other three were real cheeses. It was Colby, Monterey Jack, and Colby Jack. So I got a block of each. And I go and try them, and it turns out I can't tell the difference between them. And so I look them up. And Colby is essentially a bland or mild cheddar. It's made exactly the way cheddar is made, except at one stage, they drain off all the whey and they replace it with water. It's called a washed curd process. So you wind up getting a cheddar that doesn't have that extra acid, that extra tang or zip that the cheddar will give you. And so it is a milder form of cheddar. So then I go on to Monterey Jack. What's Monterey Jack? Monterey Jack is Colby, but without the coloring. No difference in flavor, just no coloring. They're identical cheeses otherwise. So Colby Jack is just a mix of the two, so that you get that marbled swirl, so you're looking at the orange and the white side by side, and that's all it is. That's it. All right, so three cheeses, all made exactly the same way, exactly the same flavor, just coloration differences. I was shocked, but it began to explain something to me. One, the popularity of especially Monterey Jack and Colby Jack, variations of that in restaurants where you can get them at Subway or at Applebee's or wherever. And I realized why. Because Monterey Jack sounds cool. You know what? Cheddar, American, this is boring. This is passe. This is common, really. So you want to show that you're hip and you're bold? Well, you go in somewhere, you order Monterey Jack on your cheeseburger. Yeah, suddenly you're cool. Well, you know what? When you're getting Monterey Jack, all you're getting is a bland cheddar. That's it. But it sounds cool because Monterey Jack, you can't get a cooler cheese name than Monterey Jack, right? And since it's a white cheese, by visual inspection, it is clearly not your common everyday American-style cheese that everybody else in the world eats. Monterey Jack makes you cool, right? But it's nothing but bland cheddar. That's it. And so I got this sense, this feeling inside me. I wanted to get all cheese snobby about it. You know what I mean? I wanted to get all, I understand now why people who are actually real cheese nerds, or why Europeans, why other people who have had a variety of cheeses, real cheeses, I understand why they look down on American tastes. I understand how they get to be that way, because I could feel that in myself going, oh, that's all that, oh, how dare they. And then I realized, but I still like it. Just the fact that, okay, that Colby and Monterey Jack taste exactly the same, and that they're very similar to cheddar, and they're very mild cheeses, but I still like them. They're still good cheeses. I still enjoy them. And I realized I don't need to be hating something just because it's popular. You know what I mean? Because that's all that is. That kind of snobbery. I mean, looking down on something just because everybody likes it. Well, last week we touched on zombies. And, are zombies done? Are we over them? Is it time to move on? Because, well, everybody likes zombies now. We can't possibly be into it now that the zombies have sold out on us. Except, I still do like zombies. And the more I thought about it, I listened to my own episode, because I'm narcissistic that way. I listened to my own episode from last week, and the more I thought about it, the more I was like, yeah, I do love zombies. Darn it, I'm not going to stop liking zombies just because everyone else has finally caught on. That would be silly. All right, and it's the same thing with these cheeses. But I get it. I get where the snobbery comes from, and I got to fight that urge in myself. Going all the way back to episode one of this show, what was my music for episode one? Do you remember? It was Pink. It was Pink, and I gave a big, bold lecture then about how I wasn't going to shy away from Pink, a music that I like, a song that I happen to really like. I wasn't going to shy away from it just because she's lumped in with all this bubblegum pop, just because she happens to be top 40. It doesn't mean I can't like that song. I don't like most top 40, but I like that one. All right, and so am I not allowed to like it just because it's popular? Oh, I don't know. Being a snob is just so easy, especially when we're all nerds the way we are. All right, we all have our very narrow interests that we delve deeper into than anybody else around us. And it's so easy to look disdainfully upon someone who doesn't have that depth of interest. They're maybe a passing fan, all right, but they don't know all the ins and outs. They don't know it the way we do it, and it's so easy to want to look down upon people. But why? Whoa, whoa, whoa. put the brakes on. I am sorry. I did not mean to get this preachy. I was going to talk about cheese. I was going to touch on snobbery in general, and I'm getting carried away. We need to bring this back around. So hang on a second. Let's listen to some more music.
Don't know much about history.
That's right. That music means it's time for our unnamed history segment. Okay. Jeff Hawes on our boards was recently talking about how he ran into one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. And it was at, I think, an auto place. He was waiting around for his vehicle, something. Anyway, he winds up talking to this Tuskegee Airman for like 3 hours, and he went on about how fascinating that was. And so it recalled to me the time when I was younger, seventh grade, I got to meet a Holocaust survivor who had been at Auschwitz. I mean, she was talking to just our class, 15, 20 of us maybe. And sadly, I was in seventh grade. I was 12, 13. How old are you in seventh grade? So I didn't take advantage of that. It was only later that I realized, I mean, at the time, she had a couple of horrific stories. Our teacher was kind of morbid and asked some very pointed questions that got us some shocking answers. And it was only later, though, that I realized how momentous that was to have a chance to sit down with a survivor and actually ask real questions, because she just sat and talked with us. And I'm so sorry that I passed up that opportunity, that I missed out on that. But, I was just a kid. But Jeff apparently made great use of his time. So I was inspired by that. And so as I'm thinking about all of this, it occurs to me to wonder, so how many Holocaust survivors are there that are left? How long before they're all gone? We're getting to the point where, World War I veterans are becoming a very, very rare commodity. What happens when we get to World War II veterans and Holocaust survivors, and there's just not any of them around anymore? And so I go to look, and of course, it turns out there's thousands of Holocaust survivors right this moment, because most of them, the youngest ones at the time, because, all right, if you were too young, the Nazis put you to death, because if you couldn't work in the camps, then you were of no good to them, of no use to them. And so therefore, the youngest ones would have been, mid-late teens, just as the war was ending. And those people would all be 80 to 90 right now. So, okay, 80 years old, that's not too old. I get it. There's plenty of Holocaust survivors left. But going on this train of thought, as I was flipping around through Holocaust survivor sites and seeing, where they meet up and the kind of conversations they have and this kind of stuff, I then thought, oh, wait a minute, didn't I see something recently about the last Civil War widow? So if you had to guess, how long ago did the last Civil War widow die? The last woman who was married to a Civil War veteran, how long ago did she die? And for you foreign listeners, this is the American Civil War, which was 1861, 1864, so early 1860s. So how long ago did the last Civil War widow die? Turns out, 2008, I do know. I wrote it down. I did a little show prep. She died in 2008. Oh, my God. Doesn't that seem counterintuitive? But you go read her story. Her name was Maudie Hopkins, right? Maudie Hopkins was born in 1914. So she died in 2008 at the age of 93. In 1933, she was 19 years old. She married 86-year-old, Bill Cantrell. 86-year-old Bill Cantrell, who was a Confederate soldier, a Confederate Civil War veteran. And why? Well, he was 86, she was 19. This was not an uncommon thing because, who knows, I don't know that it was necessarily a sexual relationship. She just wanted in on his pension, really. And, of course, until the Veterans Administration changed the law so that once the veteran was dead, the widows couldn't collect the pension if they were that young. But, for her, this was an extra $100-$125 a year. I suppose big money back in the 30s, I guess. And he lived another 4 years or so. And then she went on to remarry and outlive that husband and remarry again. And eventually she died at the age of 93 in 2008. I just find that an amazing fact. Just nothing big, nothing profound. I just find that amazing. But let's see if I can make a segue. You know what else is amazing? My gaming table.
I've got Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
That's right. Role-playing games, video games, card games. If it fits on my gaming table, then I am going to share it with you. And what is on my gaming table this week? I'm so excited I can't even stand it. Terror at Camp Pinewood. I don't know if that's dramatic enough, but it is. Terror at Camp Pinewood. This is a game that I've written myself. I've only playtested it one time. I played it in a really rough form 3 years ago with a bunch of Boy Scouts. But here's the deal. Originally, I wrote and played Terror at Camp Pinewood based on my story system game, which is available for free on my website. Go to the front page, go to games or free games. I can't remember how I named it. Anyway, go in there, look for story system. That's what I used to play it the first time around. It was a lot of fun. The whole idea is Terror at Camp Pinewood, which back then I think I called Scout Camp Horror, was a game of all the characters, all the players play the roles of Boy Scouts. Boy Scouts go to camp, and weird things start happening in the night. This is a week-long camp in the outdoors, and weird things happen. Their scout leader says, well, I'm going to go check this out. And he leaves to investigate and then never returns. And then more weird stuff happens. It turns into a big sci-fi horror movie, and the scouts have to use their prodigious scouting skills to figure out a way to save themselves and possibly save the rest of the camp and the world. Depending on how it plays out. And it wound up being a ton of fun. I played it with actual Boy Scouts who had been to this camp themselves, and they had a great time. I had a great time. It was a wonderful game. I'm not even going to give away all the gimmicks that went with it, but a ton of fun. So I have been in the back of my mind thinking, you know, I really need to fix this up. I really need to write this out and make something real out of it. And so what I've done with Terror at Camp Pinewood, as it's now named, is I've developed a set of rules that really support the whole scout ideology, the whole scout motto, theme, motif, that was the word I was looking for. And so what happens is, in my game, they are called Wilderness Scouts, but there's no secret that they're based very openly on Boy Scouts of America, or Boy Scouts of whatever part of the world you're from. Go for it. And anyway, your character is built around the scout motto. All right, the Wilderness Scout Creed, which, you know, talks about how scouts have to be honorable and gracious and resourceful and, you know, alert. And so those are your ability scores. Rather than strength and dexterity and constitution, you now have honor and grace, resourcefulness, fitness, all parts of the creed. So there's your first bit. Then the second part, your skills. You actually do merit badges, or in this case, readiness badges. I've renamed everything. But you get your merit badges, and this represents the skills, the things that you're good at. And then, last of all, you have your quirks, and I have a way to play that stuff into it as well. But all of these are represented in the game. This is my favorite part, represented by actual tokens. And I've got them all, I've got the sheets all done up, I print them up and cut them out. And when you play, you go to roll dice, and you start off with 3 6-sided dice, but by throwing out one of your tokens, so, okay, you know, I have a fitness token because my character is physically fit. So you throw out your fitness token, and that lets you upgrade one of your dice. All right. Or, oh, look, I have a merit badge for climbing. So you throw out your merit badge, and you get to upgrade one of your dice. And so all of it is very physical and very much based on these scouting elements. And it's just really cool. I am hoping I've got it in nearly a final form. I've got one section I need to rewrite because something came up. And then I need to add some graphics and pretty it up and, you know, do the whole layout formatting business so it looks nice. But other than that, you know, it's pretty well finished for the rules section. Now, the game itself, the scenario, the GM section of the book, if you will, is still in rough form, unwritten, but who cares? You know, you can come up with your own stories. But hopefully I'll have the player section, at least, the rules for playing this game posted up for you on the website within the next, I don't know. Well, I optimistically, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, oh, it'll only take me another week or two. But okay, realistically, if I get it done in the next month, I'll be thrilled to death. That will be awesome. I really want to share this thing with you guys because I'm really proud of it and I'm really having a good time putting it together, and I can't wait to get a chance to play it. I think this is going to be so, so cool. So hang in there. I'll be there for you. I promise. And that brings us right up to a nerd culture report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, of course not, Gonzo. But you are very, very close. This is a, you know, I told you I didn't do any show prep. I jotted this down, and now I'm looking at it going, What was I thinking as I wrote this? My amazement at technology. And I can only assume that this is last week as I was uploading the podcast. I'm pretty sure I know where this came from. As I was uploading the podcast last week, I just was floored by the level of modern technology. All right, I don't know how old any of you are, but when you were a kid, did you ever dream we'd be here? I mean, I knew from watching the Jetsons that we'd have flying cars. I understood that. I knew I'd have a robot maid. I also knew that I'd get my hair cut just by sticking my head into a big hairdryer-looking thing, and boom, it'd all come out done. But I didn't imagine this, the communication, the idea that I'm uploading my podcast. I mean, I'm sitting on my laptop in my bedroom. So I'm sitting on my bed. I've recorded an hour and a half of myself speaking, edited it away on it, and done all this stuff with it right here in my own house. And then from my bed, I upload it to the internet where people in Sweden can download it and listen to it. People in Australia can listen to me. I mean, like that. Instantly. I'm amazed by that. I never dreamed of such a thing. I mean, Lord knows, when I was in junior high, we were, you know, oohing and aahing over the idea of VCRs. You serious? I could tape a television show and watch it at a later time? You're kidding with me. Little did we know. And now, my amazement, though, and here's the thing, is not all that impressive, because I can't tell you the number of times that I am impressed by my own thumbs. Yeah, that sounds like I'm joking, but I'm not. Every once in a while, usually in a parking lot, I will be leaving Walmart, I will be leaving some store, usually Walmart, and I have 7 or 8 bags that I'm carrying all at once. And so here I have all these plastic grocery bags that I'm carrying out with me, and they're hung on my fingers. And at the same time, I'm fumbling with my keys, and I sort my keys out, and I go to open the door. And it's always this wild bit of hand contortions because, I've got the bags, and I'm balancing my something else, and I can't, trying to get the door open and pull everything out. And at moments like that, I always go, wow, thank God I'm a primate. I think that on a regular basis. And I get into my car, I get everything unloaded, and I'm like, yeah, wow, thumbs are great. I am so glad I have thumbs. Otherwise, that would have sucked. So, I'm impressed with a lot of things. I'm kind of a simple guy, really. You know what? We never should have done this Nerd Culture Report. That was completely weak, but I don't care. I finished my book. I'm going to get some sleep. Things are going to get better. Let's move on to Roku. I've been wanting to do this as a segment for a while, and I've just never gotten to it because most of the movies I watch, I lump them in under the sci-fi double feature or whatever. But I want a space simply for stuff that I find on Roku. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, Roku is the box I use to watch Netflix. All right, we also have a Wii that we can watch Netflix on as well, and my laptop sometimes. But most of the time, when I want to watch Netflix Instant Watch, when I want to watch their streaming movies and videos and stuff, I watch it on my Roku box in my bedroom. And Roku, from the beginning of time, when we first got the Roku, was always pronounced Roku, because we love it that much. Roku is amazing. And first off, and I think I've described it before, but I'll give it to you one more time. There's lots of stuff on Roku that we watch, all right? Lots of TV series, movies, all sorts of things. But my wife and I have a system whereby we play Instant Roku, and I have the Instant Roku Random Movie Generator. More correctly, in fact, it's the Instant Roku Unicorns and Butterflies Random Movie Generator, because originally it was just a random movie generator, and my wife said, well, that's really dull. You can't dress that up because it's really nothing but a series of numbers in an Excel spreadsheet, and you hit refresh, and boom, it tells you what number of movie you're going to watch. And so I dressed it up with unicorns and butterflies to mock her, and after about, 6 months of using the unicorn and butterfly model, she finally went, that is really, really kind of sissified, really. She felt we needed something a little more mature, a little more grown up. So I said, not a problem. And so I updated it to the Instant Roku Bugbears and Beholders Instant Movie Generator. And then it was really cool because I had a picture of a giant bugbear on one side and a giant beholder on the other. And bam, together they generated movies for us. And I was very, very happy. And then, sadly, I lost that file and my backup only had unicorns and butterflies on it. And I've never gone into update. So that's what we're stuck with. But we hit refresh on this thing and it gives us and tells us, okay, today you're going to watch number 273. And so we go look that one up and we watch wherever it is. And I have described this before because then we go ahead and, you know, we give it 20 minutes. And if we're both still interested at 20 minutes or either one of us is still interested at 20 minutes, well, then we watch the whole thing and we usually have a great time and we get a lot of interesting discoveries. So in addition to things like, okay, I finished up watching Firefly. You knew I was watching that one. So I watched the entire series again and had a great time. And now I'm actually in the middle of watching Serenity. And then I told you about Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. I told you about 13 Assassins. But you know what else has come up recently? 1982's The Thing. Oh, it was so good. And the timing was perfect because, you know, there's the new Thing movie, the prequel to that one. Prequel? Yeah, the prequel to that one that's just come out recently. And my second son really, really, really wants to go see that one. And so it was so cool that it came up in our instant Roku because we called him in. He's like, heck yeah, I want to watch it. And so we all sat down and we watched The Thing together. And that movie holds up. Holy cow, that movie holds up. It was really, really good. Yeah, some of the special effects are cheesy and there's some plot points that you might quibble with. But surprisingly, The Thing was really good. Now, if you've grown up in a barrel and you don't know what The Thing is, 1982 movie from John Carpenter. It starred Kurt Russell. Wilford Brimley was in it as well. And it's researchers at an Antarctic research station. Something bad comes about. Then we wind up with a horror movie, Aliens style, really. I can't believe I'm afraid of giving spoilers to a movie that is now 30 years old, but I am. So, you know what? If you haven't seen The Thing, go watch it because you'll love it. And if you have already, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Don't be afraid to go watch it again. It's really good. It's surprisingly good. I mean, I'm not saying it's a perfect movie, but it's a classic. It deserves to be watched. And it reminded me of Highlander in a lot of ways because, you know, there's other classic movies I've gone back and that I watch all the time on Roku. You know, I watch Die Hard probably every few months just because I love Die Hard that much. But Die Hard is a good movie objectively no matter what time period it's in. But The Thing reminds me a lot of Highlander. Highlander was a movie that I loved when it first came out. We were obsessed with it in college. After Highlander 2, I was so angry with Highlander 2, I've never seen anything else. I've never seen any of the other Highlander movies. I've never seen the TV show, the cartoon, none of it. To me, the first Highlander is the only one that exists, and I've put it up on this pedestal, and I've held it there forever. And I went back and rewatched Highlander, and it was cheesy, and it had some weak points in it, and yet it was still gloriously entertaining and so much fun to watch. And that's how I felt about The Thing. Yeah, there were some special effects that were really, really stupid, but then there were some that were surprisingly good. And the movie is not perfect, and I'm hoping that the new movie, the prequel version, I'm hoping takes those same elements, but, you know, updates them, makes them real, and I hope it's a good film. I haven't even looked at the reviews for it. I don't know anything about it, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. And so both of these, Highlander and The Thing, really, go back and watch them. You'll be just amazed at what parts of them hold up and how much you can actually really enjoy them at this part. I don't have a whole lot more. But I wanted to start off my Roku section, and since The Thing came up, this was my in. This was my opportunity to get the ball rolling. So hopefully you will see more of this on future podcasts, because I loves me my Roku. And even though we're a little bit early, I think, that takes us straight into the music. And this is music that I have been listening to for a while. I really love these guys. I am not going to go on and on about them, because I think a lot of you have already heard of them before. You probably even know these songs, and yet they've been popping up in my playlists lately. I have, you know, my 800 most favoritest songs in the world all on my iPod, on my playlists. And for some reason, this band, OK Go, has come up like a dozen times in the last week. And for the amount of music that I actually listen to during the day, that's a surprising amount. Because I've only got like 3 songs in the mix, and they keep coming up over and over. So without further ado, let me give you my first one from OK Go called Get Over It. Mm-hmm.
such a drag. What a chore. Oh, your wounds are full of salt. Everything's a stress. And what's more, well, it's all somebody's fault. Hey! Get over it. Hey! Get over it. Hey! Get over it. Get over it.
I dig that song. Again, I didn't do any research on the band. I didn't do any real prep for this. I don't have anywhere to go with it except to say that, God, I love that band. I love that song. So I am, though, going to lead right into a brand new segment, the in the intermusic portion between songs here where I'd usually do my badass movie quote of the week, a new segment called Right Said Thread. I'm too sexy for my forums. Too sexy for my forums. The way I'm disco dancing. Yeah, that was probably really terrible. And if I don't edit it out, count yourselves lucky that you got to hear it. Right Said Thread, because I'm really clever that way this week, is I'm just taking a thread off of my forums that really entertained me. And this one, like last time when I did the Pegacorn thread, this one is, again, another thread started by me, so it's really a tribute to my own cleverness, I suppose. But I just love the way the forum members feed into this stuff and the way they help me out with a joke. And in this one, it's the Hypnotoad thread. I started a thread called, How Much Do You Love Hypnotoad? And then you open it up, and there's a big picture of Hypnotoad with the googly eyes going because it's an animated GIF. And then my response was, I love Hypnotoad. And then immediately, I got a response from Zimnipot, that said, I love Hypnotoad. All right, and that made me laugh. And then Talvin joined in with, I love Hypnotoad. And Zen, I love Hypnotoad. By this point, each new one is just making me laugh harder and harder because that's all it needs. And then what does Paul do? No. Paul's got to march to his own drummer. Paul gives us this one. Quote, I made love to Hypnotoad, but it never called me back. So I got on the air at my local radio station where I drank 53 gallons of water to win enough money to buy a bus ticket to see Hypnotoad live in Tallahassee. My bus ticket was stolen, and I was robbed by a pack of mimes. Now my love for Hypnotoad goes unfulfilled, and I've had to shack up with Kyle to make the pain go away. But it hasn't worked. Come back, Hypnotoad. I swear, this time I won't hurt you again. Unquote. That's Paul. So, leave it to Paul to make this into a real game, huh? Ta-da! That's Right Said Thread. All right, next, it's time for the Badass Movie Quote of the Week. No prep, no intro, no nothing. Right into the quote. Quote, So I'm rappelling down Mount Vesuvius when suddenly I slip. And I start to fall, just falling. I'll never forget the terror when suddenly I realize, holy shit, Hansel, haven't you been smoking peyote for 6 straight days and couldn't some of this maybe be in your head? Yeah, that's Owen Wilson as Hansel in the movie Zoolander. Do you love Zoolander? I love Zoolander. I hated it the first time I watched it. I really did. It was one of those, I saw it and I went, yeah, I get the joke, but come on, that's stupid. You can take one dumbass character and you're going to stretch that out to an hour and a half. And then I've seen it again. And the second time, I laughed and I laughed and I laughed. I love the film. And then I can't help it. It's one of those that I love watching Zoolander. Anytime it pops up, I'll watch it because I find that crap funny. I don't care. And then, all right, this is the next one also from Hansel, same movie, Owen Wilson, where Hansel, and you've got to know the character because he's just way too hip to be a badass, and yet he gets to say, taste my pain, bitch. Oh, see, that's cool. I love Hansel. I love Owen Wilson in general. I'm usually entertained by anything he does, even when it's stupid. So, there you go. So I guess there's nothing left then, but a little bit more music. This is OK Go again. And this one, oh, here's what I will say about OK Go. Not only do I enjoy their music, I love their videos. Every video they make entertains me. Love it. For example, if you know their song Here It Goes Again, which is not going to be the song I'm going to play in just a minute, if you know Here It Goes Again, that's the one they do where they've got the four treadmills in a line and the whole group, all four band members, are on the treadmills and they're doing these dance moves where they jump back and forth between them and they spin and they... Really cool video, a lot of fun to watch, and a fun song. This song is called This Too Shall Pass, and it has kind of a marching feel to it, and sure enough, the video has a high school marching band in it, and I just think the whole video is just entertaining as all get out to watch. So if you've got the time to go waste on YouTube and watch some OK Go videos, you won't regret it. It's time well spent. But this one, This Too Shall Pass. Love that song, but you know what? Music's over. I hate segues. It's time for the Pod-O-Matic. Hot dog. This is Nerd Pride Radio's Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in this fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Well, send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, don't do that. Come over to our forum, sign up, send me your suggestions in a private message, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And this first one is number 90, which is from Serious Paul. Can't have an episode without Serious Paul anymore, can we? Serious Paul says, G.I. Joe versus Cobra. Why does Cobra always yell Cobra? Why doesn't Al-Qaeda yell, Al-Qaeda? Wouldn't that make things a lot cooler? I mean, not that I'm hoping for terrorist attacks, but if they... Yeah, you know what? That would actually be kind of morbid and weird. I think that would be strange. Cobra always yells Cobra because it's possible that amongst G.I. Joe's many and various enemies, they might not remember who they're fighting. I mean, they have so many evil organizations that pit themselves against the Joes that, you know, really, if they didn't yell Cobra, who'd know who they were? Certainly not by the uniforms, right? Okay. For the same reason, I guess, that G.I. Joe always yells, Yo, Joe? I mean, that's what we do. Number 10. This one's from Stan. Stan says, what are your favorite and least favorite pizza toppings? Please tell me you're not one of those freaks who likes anchovies. No, I don't like anchovies, or at least I think I don't like anchovies because I've never tasted an anchovy. Wouldn't be able to tell you. My favorite pizza topping, Italian sausage. That one was easy. Although I love a meat pizza of any sort. You give me a pizza with pepperoni and Italian sausage and hamburger and bacon and Canadian bacon, the whole mess, I'm thrilled to death. I think I've mentioned on podcasts before, a good Japanese pizza with some corn on it. Oh, that's awesome. Shrimp and corn. Good, good pizza. My least favorite toppings on a pizza, though, vomit. Of toppings that are actually offered at pizza places, for the most part, anything that's not meat. I mean, really, it's really hard for me to choose one from the other. I mean, I like the flavor offered by peppers and onions, even the flavor offered by mushrooms, but I don't like eating the actual vegetables themselves because I'm really weird about textures, so they bug me. Probably Probably anchovies would be a good guess. Again, I've never actually tried anchovies, and technically I've heard that it is meat, so it should fall into my love category for pizza toppings. But I would guess that if I actually saw a pizza with anchovies on it, it would keep me from eating that pizza. Whereas if I get a pizza with peppers on it, it's pizza. I'll still eat it. If it's got onions on it, mushrooms, whatever, we'll get through. Who cares, you know? You know, if the chunks are too big or the texture bothers me, I can pick those off. That's fine. But if anchovies have been on the pizza at all, yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm not eating it. You can pick the anchovies off all you want. I ain't eating no fish on my pizza. I can't even, you can get rid of it, but you know that fish oil, that fish flavor, you know that's going to soak in. You know that's going to be right there in the sauce and the crust. That's nasty. Yeah, I can't eat a fish pizza. I'm sorry. Number 62. Oh, hey, Billy Bob's back. Billy Bob says, dude, how much do you love the word awesome? Oh, you're funny. I love the word awesome a lot. You know why? It's awesome. This is something I've thought about as I listen to my own podcasts. Again, narcissist. As I listen to my own podcasts, I am often struck by how often I use words love. I say love all the time. Why? Because I love everything. I really do. Awesome. Cool. Tons of fun. I'm a very positive guy on the podcast. I love everything. That's what this podcast is about. It's about all of the coolest things in the world as far as my brain is concerned. It's all the things I think are awesome and fascinating and amazing. And so that's what I do. And the word awesome is really a great descriptor for all of that stuff. So yeah, I appreciate you pointing it out, Billy Bob. I love the word awesome. 30, number 30, from Serious Paul again. Serious Paul asks, hey, what's the Konami code again? Well, it's the code that gives you unlimited lives, or depends on the game, really. Up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, start. At least that's the original Contra code. Here's a great nerd confession. I've never used the Konami code for anything, or Contra code, or however you want to call this darn thing. I've never used it. I love that little bit of trivia. I love knowing that it exists. I love it as a meme that keeps coming back. I think there was a song by the Ataris called Up, Up, Down, Down, Left, Right, BA, Start. It's a cool little thing. It's great to know. Never actually used it for anything, but so cool. 49. This one is from... This one is from Brasky. Brasky says, hard sci-fi or soft sci-fi? I don't care. I like both. I love science fiction in any flavor at all. Hard science fiction, I love hard science fiction. Especially short stories, I love hard science fiction. I like the science behind it. I like seeing the plausibility of certain things or exploring new concepts in technology. But it doesn't all have to be that way because I love a good space opera. I love soft science fiction. I love the science fiction that's so soft it borders on just being straight up fantasy. It might as well be, swords and sorcery, but with a spaceship in it. I don't care. I like science fiction. I like fantasy. I like horror. I like all this genre, this nerd type stuff. It's all fine by me. And they all serve different purposes. I was almost going to say, I like hard science fiction as an exploration of the technology itself. But there's great hard science fiction stories that really are only, as a sideline, an exploration or examination of the technology. And yet the story itself in a hard science fiction world is still about people and emotions and the human spirit and whatever. And I have no problem with any of those in any type of sci-fi. But Brasky goes on and says, does it make a difference if it's used in a novel as opposed to television or film? Does it make a difference if it's for use in a role-playing game? Oh, that's pretty good. I was just thinking in terms of stories. I was thinking books and short stories. But, not really. It doesn't make that much of a difference. I in my books, I suppose I like hard science fiction a little bit better than soft, but I love both of them. In movies, I kind of expect most movies and TV series especially, I expect them to be softer on the technical, softer on the science fiction portion of it, simply because it's for a TV and movie audience most of the time. I mean, usually if it's going to be hard science fiction, it's because they're really taking a hard look at the science itself. But things like Star Trek and pretty soft science fiction. Star Wars, it's just straight up fantasy. Most of the sci-fi series that have been popular in the last decade or so, I would guess, have all been soft. That's just the way, that's the nature of the beast, I suppose. I don't even know really what a hard sci-fi TV show would look like. All I know is it's certainly not Doctor Who, right? But in a role-playing game, that's a good one. Because in a role-playing game, you know, I gotta tell you, I think for role-playing purposes, softer is generally better. Okay? Because, again, no. Because now that I think about it, what have I been writing with God's dice? I've been writing a city. It is a setting that is similar in some respects to GURPS's Transhuman Space. Although I started writing God's Dice, the setting, I started writing it 10 years before I ever heard of GURPS, or at least GURPS's Transhuman Space. So this is a case of parallel development of sorts. But God's Dice, I have struggled really hard with that one to make it a hard science fiction. I mean, yes, there's a lot of things that I'm kind of faking and winging it, but I want everything to be as internally consistent as possible, because that's the kind of world I want this to be. I want it to be a very realistic sort of world set 600 years in the future, but a realistic world, a realistic solar system, with believable forms of space travel and communication and genetic engineering and the way life would actually try and exist based on our modern conception of the future. And so, you know, I guess hard science fiction is it's pretty damn cool. So, yeah, you know what? I take it all back. All of my distinctions that I just made between the two of them, I don't care. Hard sci-fi, soft sci-fi, they're both awesome in any media, really. Wow, that was really non-committal. I feel terrible. R2, save me. Number 91 from Sirius Paul again. Sirius Paul asks, does the 30-sided die have any place in gaming? Oh, I'm sure we've covered this, haven't we? Because the answer is, does the 30-sided die have any place in gaming? Yes. The 30-sided die is supposed to sit in the middle of the table and look pretty and keep its mouth shut. And that's it. There's no reason to ever roll a die 30. There's no reason to ever use it in a game. It just sits there so you can show people that you have a 30-sided die. It is to impress non-gamers with the variety of dice that you own. That's it. And it's number 69, dudes. This one is also from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul says, what's your favorite TV show of all time? It's Firefly. It's Firefly. I'm pretty sure I've made that clear. I love Firefly. I am so sorry that it didn't get a fair shake or whatever happened to it. I can't believe it only got one season. I love that show. I wish it had gone on longer. I enjoyed the Serenity movie, but as a wrap-up, I wanted so much more. There were so many plot lines that just disappeared. I mean, Shepard's history, the romantic entanglement between Captain Mal and Inara, the romantic entanglement between Simon and Kaylee, getting a more detailed account of River and the Reavers. I mean, all of that was jammed into, I mean, they had to make it under 2 hours, so they all jammed it all in all at once, and I would have rather have seen all of that come out slowly over time. I would have rather see it be a real television series and go on for 3, 4, 6 seasons. I would have loved that, but we didn't get that, and so it's a shame. But Firefly, clearly my favorite TV series of all time. Number 97. And this one comes from Zimnipot. Welcome, Zimni. You know, you're really running out of entries in here, dude. You have got to send me some more because, what is this? We're getting one Zimni every 2 or 3 episodes now? You used to dominate. Oh, I'm so sorry. But number 97, Zimni says, to you, what is the meaning of life? I take it back. If you're going to send these in, dude, off the top of my head? Seriously? All right. The meaning of life. I can't tell you why we're here, but I can tell you what it is for me. And I'm actually going to give you a serious answer to this. To me, it is about being good. The meaning of life is about being good, and it's about joy. I mean, that's the best I can give you. It is, you know, I have brought 4 wonderful sons, four lovely children into this world, and I'm doing my best to bring them up with my nerd culture and my joy for life and sharing with them all the things that are wonderful about this world. And that's what this podcast is about. That's what I'm doing here is I love my life. I love the things around me. I love these things that I'm interested in, all of my nerd pursuits, everything. This is what makes me happy, and I'm so thrilled that I have a wife who is willing to share all of that with me and get excited about the same things that I do, expose me to things that are new and different and broaden my horizons. So glad that we have these children that we can bring up to be, hopefully, in the end, good people who can take joy out of life and spread that around. That's what I want to do, all right? A little schmaltzy, maybe a little preachy, don't care. That's what I'm doing here, and I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. So, thank you, Zimny. I'll take more questions from you anytime. Number 26. Again from Brasky. Quick, off the top of your head and without thinking about it, on a scale of 9.5 to 10, how hot is Susan Boyle? Oh, Susan Boyle. 10. 10. Absolutely. All right, I know she's not much to look at, but have you heard that voice? The pipes of an angel? Oh, my Susan. Number 83, from Jeff Hawes. And Jeff Hawes says, favorite instant game moment? Wow, that is a great question, because you know how loves me my instant game. This favorite moment. It's been a while since I've played, but all right. I got two of them that I can think of, my two favorite games that I played in instant game. One was the Drunken Monkey fighting Ben Franklin. Campy cloned historical figures. That was this one. And when the cloned historical figures break out of their facility and they take on the army of Bruce Lee clones, and immediately Ben Franklin drops down into his drunken monkey fighting stance, I laughed. That was awesome. That was a spectacular moment. But I also, and I wish I could come up with the exact moments, because there was some really good stuff. I have the transcripts. I should post those or at least go through them and dig out some good moments. But when we played the plague-ravaged London, it was me and Kaz and Flame. Was it Flame? No, it was Kaz, Eliahad. Can't remember who the other person was. Maybe it was Flame, maybe it was Darks, maybe it was... I don't remember. Anyway, we played 12th century London. The plague has ravaged the countryside, and they're playing peasants and ordinary people within the city just trying to survive, and they all happen to be in the right area. Yeah, it was Flame. It was Flameblade. And they just happen to be in the right area when a time traveler from several hundred years in the future shows up looking to break into the crypts under the church and steal Excalibur from its resting place. And I just remember that one being really dramatic. I remember lots of good use of hero points and getting them. I mean, it was really tense, really tense. It kind of fell away on the second half. It kind of lost a little bit of something, but boy, the first bit as the dramatic tension was building up, it was a really good game. I really miss that. I should really get some instant game going, honestly. But good question. Thank you. Number 31. Hey, it's from Daz. We haven't heard from Daz since last week. Hey, Daz. Daz says, D&D 5th edition, now? I mean, WTF, really? Okay. You know what? I'm not going to answer this, Daz. Nice try. Not going to do it, but I'll tell you what I will do. I promise you that D&D 5th edition, or D&D Next, or whatever they're calling it, that will be my gaming table topic for episode 24 next week. Because I actually have a lot of things to say about this. And not to get... Well, you know what? I'm not even going to go into it. Why am I doing that to myself? No, because I want to do this one justice. Because if I do it right now, I am going to get slipshod all over it. And I don't want to do that. So we'll save it for next week. But excellent question, because it's been on everybody's mind, right? All right, R2, can you give me one last one to take us out of here? Wow, number 3. That is from... It's from Scree. Hey, Scree. Scree says, dude. He calls me dude. Dude, on September 19th, 2012, could you do something piratey? Could I ever? I love September 19th. It's Talk Like a Pirate Day. Trust me, Me and Yancey celebrate Talk Like a Pirate Day every single year. And you do it, and the sad part about Talk Like a Pirate Day is you really have to commit to it. Because you start talking like a pirate in the morning, and the first couple of people you run into at work, you wind up talking like a pirate, and they're like, what is wrong with you? And you're like, arr, it be International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And then they go, and they always roll their eyes, and you give you that look like you're a complete and total idiot. And that's where your resolve starts to break down. That's where it's like, yeah, but it's Talk Like a Pirate Day. I've got to keep this up, but it's so hard to do in the face of all of that disdain. It is a really tough holiday, and you really got to work it. Okay, but even more important than Talk Like a Pirate Day, you know what else is September 19th? Hermione Granger's birthday. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, not the actress. Hermione Granger herself, the fictional character from Harry Potter. Her birthday is September 19th. And it's always such a shame because, you know, I'd love to have a little simple celebration, you know, in honor of Hermione every year on her birthday. But I have to talk like a pirate while I'm doing it, and it seems kind of disrespectful, right? So I usually skip the Hermione stuff because, I guess talking like a pirate's more important, isn't it? And that brings us to the end. This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. Featured music this week was OK Go with Get Over It and This Too Shall Pass. The opening and closing theme is from the Beastie Boys' Sabotage as performed by the Penelopes. Bumper clips this week were taken from Sam Cooke's Wonderful World and Weezer's In the Garage. All bumper music is available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. I would not put them in my show if I didn't love those songs, and I mean that. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write us a nice review. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdpride.radio, but we all know that would be a huge waste of time. Or you can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the very best way to talk to me is to come sign up for the forum at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we'll hang out, we will have fun. This is part two of the lecture Anti-Captain by Ronnie Benlevy, originally given September 15th, 2266. So what is it about Star Trek that so endears it to us? The science? The stories? The characters? I mean, it can't be the individual plot lines that have so enamored generations. Heck, every incarnation of Trek thus far has been accused of simply recycling cliched plots from other sci-fi and fantasy sources. Moreover, every incarnation of Trek since Next Generation has been accused of stealing baldly from its own predecessors. Such charges clearly have merit on some level. I mean, authors from William Shakespeare to William Corning have been renowned by building on the successes of others. The stories of Trek, while sometimes very powerful, very thought-provoking, have been played and replayed in dozens, if not hundreds, of other sci-fi venues over the centuries. Nor can it actually be the science of it. The real world has so often rendered Star Trek technology obsolete that critics are perfectly justified in calling Star Trek more fantasy than science fiction. After all, the most essential technologies of the Trek world, warp drives, force fields, transporters, replicators, holodecks, chronolapsers, none of these have come to pass. These hallmarks of Star Trek technology remain just as much fantasy to us as dragons, witches, unicorns. On the reverse side of that, the most revolutionary aspects of our own real world science, organic information structures, nanotailoring, simtech, cybernetics, countless others. These all had to be practically forced down Star Trek's collective throat to be included in their canon material. The implications of something even as basic as computerized communication largely escaped the writers of the original series. It wasn't until computers reshaped the mindscape of the real world did we then see them retroactively fitted to our beloved Star Trek. Actually, until reality itself forces them to embrace it, the writers of Star Trek most often use new technology simply as villainous constructs, like the Borg as it originally appeared in Next Generation, or as mere plot devices, like the Chimera Planet from Voyager New Frontiers. In both cases, these were technologies that literally reshaped humanity in the real world. But they were merely story fodder for Star Trek. Cyber technology was barely in its infancy when Next Generation was written. Not able to see that true revolution that was still over 5 decades away, the Next Generation writers had Geordi LaForge's cybervisor. They even had Commander Data, a fully artificial being, exploring his own humanity as a machine. And yet, when they presented a vision of cybertech fully enveloping a culture, fully changing the nature of a society, it became the Borg, with its obvious Frankensteinian comment on the dangers of technology. Similarly, in the real world, the first non-human nano-tailoring projects were in mass production by the end of the 21st century. And in 2250, ethnologists were already predicting that pure humans will be a world minority by 2300. But way back in 2147, as this technology was still barely out of its infancy stages, the writers of Voyager and New Frontiers used it as the basis of their Chimera planet. But rather than being a visionary piece of futurism, nanotailoring was just an excuse to put the New Frontiers crew into yet another deceptive puzzle box and test their moral fortitude as they found their way out. You know, the ramifications of such massive and widespread genetic alteration wasn't even touched on in those episodes. It was something that could have revolutionized every facet of human life, and in real life, eventually did. And yet, Trek left all of those questions completely unaddressed until over a century later, after scientists and philosophers in this real world of ours had already wrestled with those problems and come to some conclusions on their own. Missed opportunities, some might say. But I disagree. Star Trek has always been about reflecting the face of the current human condition, not about trying to predict where humanity might go someday. And it seems like an odd thing to say about a science fiction story, but it brings us closer to the truth of Star Trek's universal and long-lasting appeal. Star Trek's enduring popularity springs from hope. Or maybe, actually I should say, it springs from hope with a capital H. Gene Roddenberry created the original Star Trek as, in his words, a mirror of mankind, a way of examining the best and the worst of the human condition in the guise of fantastic technologies and surprisingly human aliens. And in examining the human condition, the overarching theme of almost every incarnation of Trek has been one of hope. Even in their darkest moments, these series are pervaded with a powerful optimism and a burning confidence in the triumph of good over evil. Trek roots itself in the popular consciousness with an optimistic embodiment of each era's finest qualities. In every version of the Trek universe, Starfleet represents the noblest aspects of humanity as defined by the era that created it. And that's the important part, as defined by the era that created it. And that utopian spirit is personified in the character of the Enterprise captains. It doesn't matter who runs the Federation or the Continuum or even who runs Starfleet itself. All that matters is the person helming the quote-unquote flagship of humanity. And according to most scholars, every Enterprise captain, with one notable exception, has fulfilled that promise, at least by the standards of his or her own day. Looking back, Jim Kirk's rugged, two-fisted misogyny now seems primitive, anachronistic. Jean-Luc Picard's socialist utopianism, merely naive and quaint to our modern eyes. Mara Rupont and her scientific morality is almost frightening today in its calculating detachment, and yet, each of these and the dozen others who've borne that mantle of captain of the USS Enterprise were considered models of human perfection to the societies that created them. Even figures like Benjamin Sisko, Norash Wong, Son of Korg, these pseudo-captains of the Trek universe, they stand as paragon-like figures of the ages that created them. Every incarnation of the Star Trek paradigm offers up a hopeful and bountiful future, a world better than the one we suffer daily. And the captain of each new version is the personal embodiment of that hope, noble, compassionate, strong. Except, of course, for one. As has been noted previously, Samuel W. LaForge, captain of the Enterprise from 2497 to 2484, was an unadulterated bastard. End of part 2.